It's Wednesday, September the 11th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. In a little while, we'll be joined by our new Northern correspondent, Freya McClements, and by Alex Kane to discuss the position of unionism in relation to the ongoing negotiations over the backstop and Brexit and everything else that we've been hearing about on and on and on and on over the last while. But first, with me in studio is our political editor, Pat Leahy. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Hugh.
Pat, you have a, there's a tripartite byline here. You, Fia Kelly and Eoin Burke Kennedy write the lead story in today's Irish Times. And it's about Pascal Donoghue's plans for the budget in the light of all this uncertainty over Brexit.
Yes, the thrust of this story, Hugh, the background to this story is that Mr. Donoghue's been saying since, for some months back now, that the government would make a decision in September whether or not it would prepare the budget on the basis of no deal, or what would be the context or background to the preparation of the budget. Not surprisingly, I'm told that they have reached the conclusion that they will have to prepare the budget, which is to be delivered in just under a month's time, on the 8th of October, that they will have to prepare that budget on the basis of that there will be a no deal. So there'll be a discussion about that in Cabinet today. It's the first, the last meeting, rather, before the return of the Dáil next week. And it takes place just as the budget, the process for agreeing the budget is really kicking into gear behind closed doors in government buildings, and that will dominate a lot of what happens behind the scenes in government over the coming weeks. But
so what does that mean? Preparing that it's a no deal budget. What does that mean in terms of spending decisions, I suppose, in particular?
Well, there's two points, I think. First of all, I suppose part of the job of Minister for Finance at this time of the year when the budget's being prepared is always to
tell his colleagues to shag off.
I was going to put it more delicately than that, but precisely thus, yes. And I suppose it strengthens his hand in terms of saying no to his colleagues and their requests for further spending. It also, I suppose, plays to that school of thought in Fine Gael, which holds that the most important political job for the party in government to do this autumn is to regain, as they see it, their reputation for fiscal prudence, for economic competence, which took quite a battering in the early part of the year with stories of overspending on capital projects. People will remember the National Children's Hospital, the inflating cost of the National Broadband Plan, continuing overspending in the Health Department, or spending beyond their allocated budgets in the Health Department, and so on. So that there is a strong school of thought in Fine Gael that as they approach an election, they must regain their credibility on that. And because the budget is, in a way, the biggest political megaphone of the year, it's a time when ordinary people who don't necessarily follow politics on a day-to-day basis sit up and take notice of what the government says, because they know it affects them in their daily lives. And so they view the budget as an opportunity to get across that message of fiscal prudence. However, that must also be balanced with the traditional Irish imperative that this is the last budget before an election.
Sure,
so we must spread out the goodies insofar as possible. And you and many of our listeners will have spotted that, of course, both these objectives are in conflict.
They're downright incompatible. But in a way, it strikes me that in a weird sort of a way, the prospect of a no Brexit deal at the end of no deal Brexit, I should say, at the end of October, horrifying though it is for many people, is it maybe a little bit of a gift to Pascal Donoghue to achieve what his political objectives would be? Because if that threat was not there, you know, the economy is going well, there would be, you know, really significant pressure for, you know, there's lots of places more money needs to be spent in the health service, on housing, etc., etc., etc. There might be pressure for, you know, some kind of, you know, tax cuts of one sort. So it sort of removes a lot of those political pressures, doesn't it?
I'm not sure it removes them entirely. I've been writing in as much detail as I can manage about budgets for several years, and it never ceases to amaze me the extent to which individual ministers subscribe to the general proposition of prudence and economic economic carefulness, if you like, but believe that it should apply to all the other ministers apart from themselves, because they of course have special reasons for an increase in their budget and for an extension of programmes and so forth. What it does do is it strengthens Pascal Donoghue's defence against those spending demands that are coming across the table at him in the budget bilateral meetings, which will kick off over the coming weeks. And so to that extent, you're right, it's a good thing for him. The threat of a no-deal budget is a help to him. If a no-deal budget, of course, actually happens, a no-deal Brexit actually happens, that will quickly turn into a nightmare for Pascal Donoghue, because as the Fiscal Advisory Council points out in its report this morning, to which we also refer in our front page report, that would probably open up quite a big deficit next year.
Okay, and briefly just, what also about the people who aren't in government but who have a say in all this, which is Fianna Fáil?
Yeah, and there was a meeting last night, as I understand it, between Fianna Fáil, finance spokesman Michael McGrann, their public expenditure spokesman Barry Cowan, and Pascal Donoghue, who of course holds both briefs for the government. I think it'll be interesting to see how Fianna Fáil play this. My guess is that they will mirror a lot of what goes on in government, in that they will subscribe to the overall goal of prudence, but will have specific asks themselves that they will want to see presented in the budget, and which they can then claim to be budgetary wins for them. One final point I think to note on this is that the way the budget process works nowadays is that it isn't just one big reveal of everything on the day, so that we know largely the shape of the budget to come because of the summer economic statements and previous documents published by the Department of Finance over the course of the year. And the summer economic statement said budget will be about the expansionary budget to the tune of about 2.8 billion, but 2.2 billion of that is already pre-committed in previous policy announcements by the government. So the budget day leeway is about 600 million. Now, what the government has done in recent years is that it has expanded that smaller budget day discretionary chunk into something beyond up to 1.5 billion. And what I think will happen this year because of the threat of no-deal Brexit is I think there will be downward pressure on that budget day expansion. So the actual budget won't be a whole lot different because of the threat of a no-deal Brexit. What will happen next year if there is a no-deal Brexit, according to the government, is it won't affect its tax and spending plans for next year. It will simply run a much bigger deficit next year. It's the following year's budget that the squeeze would really come on the government's public finances.
Okay, very interesting. Stick with us, Pat. We're going to be discussing the renewed prospect of a potential Northern Ireland-only backstop. Right, and Pat is still with us. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by our brand new Northern correspondent, Freya McClements. Freya, you're very welcome.
Great to be here, thank you.
Also joined by Alex Kane, who's a political columnist, and he's a former director of communications for the Ulster Unionist Party. Alex, can I go to you first? I was watching TV last night, Primetime and RTE, and Geoffrey Donaldson, the DUP MP, was on, and he was all sweetness and light and honey about the positive efforts being made by the Irish government to resolve the issues around the backstop and Brexit, and how there was goodwill on all sides, and he was optimistic. Was that a front, or is that the DUP's position at the moment, that they're optimistic about how this is all going to turn out?
Oddly enough, I think it's a mixture of both, because I think the DUP have now realised after being, I think, let down by Theresa May when the backstop first came into the public domain, and then let down again by Boris Johnson when he came to their party conference last year and said that he opposed the withdrawal agreement and opposed the backstop. A few weeks later, went and voted in favour of it. So I think their fear is that in terms of can they trust Boris Johnson to always act in their interests, I think deep down, they may not say so publicly, but deep down they would have very grave reservations. But I think that means they know they now need to make sure that the relationship between themselves and the Irish government in particular is much better than it has been. Because the truth in all of this is that I think if you ask what is the key mistake that the DUP has made in the past 2 years since they did the first confidence and supply arrangement with the Conservative Party, I think that mistake was to cut off all relationships with the other parties in Northern Ireland, to cut off the joint approach which Martin McGuinness and Arlene Foster had originally signed up to. Indeed, had sent a letter to Theresa May saying they wanted to do things jointly. They wanted to talk to the Irish government together. They wanted to talk to Juncker together. As soon as the confidence and supply deal was done, all of that was dropped because the DUP, for reasons best known to themselves, went into uber-unionist mode, assumed that they controlled the government would do exactly what they wanted, realised it wasn't going to do it, and now realise that Boris Johnson, in the next few weeks, has to make a very critical decision between his increasingly nationalistic party and the Brexit Party and the interests of the DUP. And I think the DUP have now realised that in that decision-making, they may not come out on top.
Freya, when we talk about the DUP right now, are we talking about an entirely united party that speaks with one voice? Or within that, are there different perspectives and maybe different interests?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the inevitabilities about Northern Ireland politics is that nothing, if you like, is ever that united. You know, it's nothing really ever with one voice. So when we talk about the DUP, you know, inevitably there are different shades of opinion and sort of views within that. The DUP have sort of been saying very clearly on this, you know, that the party, its MPs are united. You know, they're supporting Arlene Foster in terms of what she's saying about how pleased they are in terms of what Boris Johnson has been saying to them, that there will be no Northern Ireland only backstop, that that's ruled out. You know, so publicly, you know, there's this very united face that's been being presented. I mean, Jim Wells, for example, speaking this morning on the Stephen Nolan show on BBC Radio Ulster, himself saying quite freely that he was open to some form of potentially this all Ireland food standard zone. So within this, the agreed policy statements, if you like, you know, the formal statements that are coming out from the DUP saying, you know, we've been assured by the Prime Minister that there's going to be no Northern Ireland only backstop. When you break that down and you see what individual MPs are saying, what individual party members are saying, that's quite different. I mean, Nigel Dodds mentioning the possibility of arrangements on Newsnight a few nights ago. You know, the question is, what might those arrangements be? You know, you've Ian Paisley Jr. saying, well, you know, the DUP aren't going to be thrown under a bus here by the Tory government, by Boris Johnson. And then this question, I mean, even Arlene Foster herself this morning on Radio Ulster, ruling out the backstop, but not ruling out a backstop, you know. So I think where we're going now is we're going deep into the language. You know, it might be a backstop or a form of a backstop, but it might not be called a backstop.
Pat, what's been going on over the last few days? And as if you open the British newspapers now over the last 24 hours or so, you'll see more and more focus, the spotlight turning back to Northern Ireland, where it wasn't for a very long time. And that's partly because some of the flags that were raised by Boris Johnson over the last week or so. But it's also more broadly, it seems to be the perception, particularly among the Conservative press, is that if there is to be any solution in advance of the 31st of October, it will centre on all-Ireland arrangements of some sort, whether they're called a backstop or not.
Yeah, and this was first raised by Boris Johnson last week, where he referenced the All-Ireland arrangements for animal health and suggesting that perhaps, you know, that could extend into other areas. And you're right, there has, seems to me, been, you know, a sudden focus in London on the possibility of a return to the Northern Ireland only backstop in perhaps an amended form with additional quote-unquote democratic controls on it, which presumably involves some sort of a role for Stormont.
Would that be a big concern for Dublin? A role for Stormont?
In the previous Northern Ireland backstop incarnation, it was a concern for Dublin because it was seen by Dublin as giving a danger of an absolute veto to the unions, who would just say no to everything. But if there is going to be a deal, there will have to be some movement on all sides. And partly, I think this focus has come back to the Northern Ireland only one because there is the bones of a solution to it already on the shelf, was already negotiated. A lot of it, how it would work, was thrashed out in the negotiations between the UK and the EU. And so therefore you're not starting from scratch, because of course, given the time constraints, starting from scratch and designing a whole new solution is not really possible. The front of the Daily Telegraph I'm looking at this morning is, could Johnson have the answer to solve the Brexit deadlock, pointing again at the Northern Ireland only one, though I see that part of it is the suggestion from Boris Johnson that there could be a bridge from Northern Ireland to Scotland. So I'll leave that to listeners to judge the immediacy or likelihood of that particular aspect of it. I remain somewhat sceptical of it, to be honest. I'm not sure. I think there will be serious negotiations on it, and certainly people that I've spoken to in and around the Irish government expect there to be serious negotiations on this over the coming weeks. One of them was saying to me that he expects things will kind of go a bit dark now, and that will be a good sign, a sign that that there is serious negotiations in play. And I heard Tommy Gorman, a man for whom whose judgment I have a lot of respect on these matters, was sounding very optimistic on Morning Ireland about it this morning. But as I say, I remain somewhat sceptical, because I am not sure it is in Boris Johnson's strategic political interest to do it.
Yes, Alex, can I ask you about it? Because I share Pat's scepticism, because it seems to me that most likely by far that there won't be a deal between in the last 3 weeks in October, and that most of what Boris Johnson is doing is preparing himself for the inevitability of an election, which would probably happen. It would probably happen in November, and that therefore everybody else is positioning themselves as well, including the DUP. Nobody wants the blame to, you know, if it's a game of musical chairs, nobody wants to be left standing when the blame is being allocated, and so that everybody needs to show willingness. Boris Johnson, for example, needs to some extent rebut the accusations which we heard from Amber Rudd most recently at the weekend, that there isn't really a serious engagement and a serious negotiation. So to be seen to be doing all this and to be seen to be willing is just part of the game as it's being played right now at this moment.
I think that's true. I mean, I know I'm naturally pessimistic in all of these things, but I do take the view that the more noise I hear from the parties and the more upbeat they sound, the more I conclude that absolutely nothing is happening. You know, whether it's the going dark talks or so on. It's when they say things that, you know, that where they raise questions, which basically they said, this is a question which needs to be answered and maybe people can address it. When they do that sort of thing, I take them seriously. But when they do this, oh, we're willing, we want this to work and everybody wants a deal, I'm increasingly sceptical. And in terms of what Boris Johnson is trying to do, I think he has two problems. He has his own party, which he's pushing further and further to the right. He's Nigel Farage biting on the seams. He's even more right-wing than him. And he has to make a decision about, can he keep Northern Ireland, you know, complete, integral inside the United Kingdom and get away with that in terms of his own votes? Because it's quite clear that the vast majority of let's call it the English nationalists, don't give a stuff one way or the other about keeping Northern Ireland. But Johnson doesn't want to go down as a prime minister who loses part of the United Kingdom. So he has that to deal with. But on the bigger issue, which they now seem, the DUP and Johnson do seem to be trying to tie some sort of solution to this problem on, let's call it a soft backstop. It's not going to be a hard backstop, but it's a backstop of some sort. The DUP want the Stormont included in that, but as it stands, we've had almost 3 years without Stormont. I see absolutely no sign whatsoever of Sinn Féin and the DUP coming close to a deal. If a deal was possible, you know, in terms of a softer backstop, Sinn Féin would still be demanding, as a very basic, the most basic thing they would want before they would do anything, is a guarantee from the Democratic Unionist Party that there would be an Irish Language Act. I don't see the DUP being able to sell that. So I think, yes, we're getting a few weeks of this chitter-chatter with the DUP certainly expecting an election, with Johnson desperate for an election. So all I'm seeing now, and again, maybe I'm being overly pessimistic, but all I'm seeing now is an awful lot of chatter without any sense of, because if the DUP are saying they can buy a backstop, this, if it involves electricity and agriculture, that they could buy that, it's still a bit of a U-turn for them, but it's possible. They need the Assembly, and they can't get the Assembly without an Irish language. And really, I mean, the DUP would have a tremendous sell, you know, to their own people. I'd say, oh yes, first of all, we've had the U-turn on the backstop, and B, we've had the U-turn on an Irish language. I think that would be almost impossible for them to do.
Freya, do you agree with that?
Well, I tend to be more optimistic than Alex.
Everyone is more optimistic than me.
Well, true. There are dead people
more optimistic than Alex.
But I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that the optimism is correct. I mean, in recent weeks, I've swung from sort of thinking that it was going to be all right to and it'll be sorted out to thinking that, you know what, it is going to be no deal. And actually, in the last few days, I've begun to see what I think are potentially the glimmers of this being sorted out. So I think while I take Alex's points in terms of the difficulty of selling this, of the DUP selling this to its supporters, I think we are starting to see that subtle change in language. And I think Nigel Dodd's mention of arrangements I think was really key, because we are starting to see that maybe there is a way through here. And I mean, I remember speaking to one of the negotiators of the Good Friday Agreement, and he talked about actually what you need in agreements is you need language that gives you wriggle room. You need language that gives you room for compromise. Jim Wells, again this morning, his language, you know, he's very much trying to sort of turn on the head of a pin here, in that he's saying, well, this, you know, regulatory alignment over agri-food isn't really a backstop at all. It's completely different, because actually Northern Ireland would be in control of it, not the EU would be in control. So we're not ceding any constitutional change. We're not giving away control. We're keeping the control. So, you know, yeah, you know, it's complicated. There's a way to go. I think there's maybe the glimmer of something, because again, don't forget, I mean, we're talking about ideas of regulatory alignment in terms of agri-food. You know, a lot of those arrangements exist in terms of the island of Ireland anyway. You know the island of Ireland is a kind of a single phytosanitary unit anyway, you know, in terms of things like agriculture. Given the negotiations that have taken place already, it shouldn't be a huge leap to extend that. And again, maybe it's back to language, I think.
Pat, I have to say I share Alex's scepticism and pessimism more than Freya's conditional optimism, because when you look at what's being talked about there, the complexities of the all these areas around All Ireland arrangements, then you add to that the it seems to me very narrow possibility of the Assembly being reconstituted in this very short window of time. And then on top of that, you put the current environment in the House of Commons where, you know, let's not forget that the confidence supply agreement is effectively over, because Boris Johnson is, you know, is 20 seats or more off having a majority government even with the DUP. And then you look at what are the rational expectations or objectives of Boris Johnson, which have to be to go to an election. Is everybody not really playing now for the election itself and the post-election landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I don't hold with the view that this is all about the blame game, but certainly that is in some people's minds. I mean, Freya mentioned there Boris Johnson's priorities. And I think if we try and examine what his strategy is, because ultimately if there is to be a deal, it will require Boris Johnson to strong arm the DUP into accepting something that he can then get through this existing House of Commons. And that seems to me to be a very big ask. My view has always been, as you know, that Boris Johnson's first priority, and to strategize is to prioritize, and his first priority is to change the numbers in this House, change the numbers in the House of Commons, because he can get neither a deal nor a no deal through given the current numbers. So he must have an election. And I can see a couple of weeks of activity with people trying to come up with something in the North, failing before the EU summit, and Boris Johnson then throwing his hands in the air, resigning, sending somebody else, and let another prime minister, then a caretaker prime minister, be it Jeremy Corbyn or Ken Clark or somebody, who would go to Brussels, ask for the extension, and an election will take place in November, which would then be fought by Boris Johnson on his preferred ground of being the only man who can deliver Brexit, albeit at the end of January, untainted by asking for the extension, which he has promised since he came to office that he will not do, but still able to fight that election as the Brexit candidate. It seems to me that is what is most in his strategic interest, albeit that it requires him to do something that politicians almost never do, which is give up office voluntarily. But that, I think, is his only way to fighting that election on the grounds most propitious for him. And if I'm right about that, then it means that these talks are unlikely to succeed.
And Alex, if Pat is right about that, and if there is an election, is this not extremely dangerous ground for Ulster unionism in general and the DUP in particular, in that the two most likely outcomes, well, set aside a hung parliament, which is, you know, quite a possible outcome as well, it might be good for the DUP and by their lights, but you'll either have a strengthened Boris Johnson with a comfortable majority, who's then in a position to do the betraying of Ulster, which Freya was saying everybody in Ulster, all the Ulster unionists expect in the first place anyway, or even worse, you'll have a government probably of Jeremy Corbyn supported by the Scottish Nationalists, which will be the most anti-union government in the history of the United Kingdom.
Well, I think the ironic thing for unionists, when you talk to people who've been in the game a long time, you know, politically and electorally, and have been to Westminster and so on, they will often tell you that from a unionist perspective, a Labour government has been more helpful to them, because it's the old, I've forgotten who first said it, but you can't be betrayed by an opponent, you can only be betrayed by a friend, and that generally speaking, the Labour Party has done less to unsettle unionism than to successive Conservative governments have. So while there may be some fear of Corbyn and Scottish nationalism, I think unionists would actually be more fearful of Boris Johnson coming back with a solid majority, but also having to deal with Farage's Brexit Party, maybe some of them even in the House of Commons, where they, you know, who want this clean Brexit, this purest Brexit, and suddenly, well, what price are you willing to pay? Are you willing to let Northern Ireland go? So I think, oddly enough, you know, a thumping majority for right-wing English nationalism would cause huge problems for unionism, or existential problems. But the other thing in terms of the election and how it's run, Democratic Unionist Party do have a problem. They have two things to try and explain. The first one is, well, hang on, guys, you did this deal with Theresa May. You built this relationship now with Boris Johnson. Both of these guys have let you down. You said originally you would never have a backstop. Now you're talking about a soft backstop. So I think the DUP will completely ignore all of that. They will push all that to one side and go back to what they do best, which is the knee-jerk reaction that you run this election basically on. Unionism has to get its best ever result, because this will in essence be a de facto border poll. So it'll be about maximising the unionist vote. The only message, it won't be a message about the backstop, it won't be a message about Brexit, it won't be a message about anything else other than the DUP saying on every single doorstep, we have to maximise the unionist vote to kill off the argument in favour of a border poll. I think that is all, and oddly enough, I think that will help. The Ulster Unionist Party, my old party, has been all over the place. It doesn't have an alternative. The Progressive Unionist Party is almost dead. Jim Allister's TUV has no significant role. And at a moment like this, I actually think we're going back to 1986, January 1986 territory, the post-Anglo-Irish agreement. I think you will see all of unionism possibly getting its biggest ever vote, but all rallied around the Democratic Unionist Party. That doesn't solve the other problems, because you still have the existential question about the Brexit and so on. But this election, the DUP are not worried about this election, in my view, because the DUP have already factored in that this is they are running this election as a border poll. Nothing else matters to them. And they will, whatever happens in terms of the election result, they will deal with at that point. They expect to come back with 10 MPs. They expect Sinn Féin still not to take their seats. So from their point of view, things will, even if they don't hold the balance of power, there will still be that sense of normalcy from their point of view.
Frey, it's very interesting to hear Alex say that. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me in the course of this conversation was, if somebody was listening to it from a nationalist or indeed a non-unionist, an alliance or other perspective in Northern Ireland, they say, we haven't mentioned the majority of the people who voted against Brexit in Northern Ireland, who haven't been represented in all these negotiations in any way. We're not going to get into the whole Sinn Féin not taking up their seats in Parliament business. But what is the impact on the majority of the people now in Northern Ireland who are outside the traditional unionist parties, and Sinn Féin, the SDLP, Alliance of the Greens?
Yeah, essentially I agree with Alec in that this is where the interplay between what's happening in terms of Brexit and what's happening in terms of Westminster kind of collides, if you like, with the reality of politics in Northern Ireland. The reality is that by and large, broadly speaking, any election in Northern Ireland, people tend to vote on the orange and green issues. They tend to vote, it's about nationalist or unionist. And I'm sort of, you can hear me sort of slightly hesitant when I say that, because I'm aware, for example, that there's been the increasing levels of support for the Alliance Party, and particularly shown at the European elections there with the election of Naomi Long. But I think a European election, the context for that is always slightly different to what we'd be talking about here, which is a Westminster election. What you've seen since the collapse of the Northern Ireland Assembly in January 2017, the turnout has increased and it's kept increasing. And what we've seen in that increasing turnout, but also an increasing vote for either the DUP or for Sinn Féin, and quite, you know, to put it bluntly, I mean, it's as Alex said, you know, it's because the DUP will say to people, look, if you want to protect the union, but actually not even so much protect the union, you need to stop a United Ireland, you need to stop Sinn Féin being in a position where they might be able to take First Minister rather than Deputy First Minister, then you need to vote for the DUP, because we are the only people who can stop that.
Right, I know you're both very busy, Freya and Alex, so we will let you go now. Pat, Freya's pretty bleak analysis there essentially says that every election, and certainly the one just about to come up in Northern Ireland, is essentially a border poll. And you were writing in your Saturday column about why a border poll is a bad idea.
Well, up to a point. I think what Freya was saying is that, you know, it's just, we are seeing the extension of the Brexit effect from Great Britain, the politics of Great Britain, which is, of course, distinct from the politics of Northern Ireland, into Northern Ireland. The Brexit effect of dividing and polarising and deepening divisions and reinforcing those divisions, the pre-existing divisions, is extending to Northern Ireland. The point I was making about the border poll at the weekend was that given the, and of course, leaving here to go up to the Sinn Féin think-in near Dundalk.
Where they're waiting for you with open arms up there.
No doubt these subjects will be discussed. And I was critical of Sinn Féin for beating the unity poll drum with increasing fervour. I made the observation, which actually I made the previous week as well, but to which, despite voluminous correspondence from voluminous and welcome correspondence from many people online, I still haven't got an answer for. And that question is, if you are serious in talking to unionists about a united Ireland, why do you make Gerry Adams your spokesman on a united Ireland? And as I say, I haven't received a satisfactory answer to that yet. But the point, the general point I was making, was that given what the experience of the Brexit referendum has done to British politics and society, that we should think very carefully, prepare very assiduously, and ruminate slowly and over a period of time before we would jump into a referendum here, which has the potential, it seems to me, to have similar but even more polarising effects.
Which is not
here
to say that, I mean, we had a very interesting podcast a little while ago with Brendan O'Leary, and he talked about the importance of discussing these matters in a more structured and sophisticated way than we have done so far. The issues of the constitutional arrangements on this island.
I don't have any dispute with that whatsoever, nor am I saying that people can't talk about a united Ireland. Clearly that would be preposterous, and the entire history of this country suggests that the issue will come on the agenda at some stage. What I was pointing out is that, to repeat what it seems to me were the mistakes of the UK in jumping in to a referendum for which they were utterly unprepared, and whose outcome either way, or one way anyway, was something that people had no firm views or plan about. To repeat the same here with the United Ireland. And let's face it, the divisions between Leavers and Brexiteers in the UK are nowhere near as deep or as long seated, as deeply seated as the divisions on this island. I think to repeat that mistake would be an act of folly.
Pat, thanks for coming in today. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks also to Alex and Freya for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon. And remember, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Acast, or whatever your preferred podcast provider might be. And you can find us at irishtimes.com/podcasts. Your views are always extremely welcome. You can mail me at hlinehan@irishtimes.com, or you can find me on Twitter. Until the next time, thanks for listening.